Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hi, this is Josh Marshall, and this is the Josh Marshall Podcast. We are one day before the election. We're doing our episode, our main episode this week, one day early, just because Tuesday, our normal day, is election day. And election days are sort of, they're almost like kind of like an information black hole. It's all down to the voting, and we don't really know new information. And there's always a lot of what I would call like non-information on election day. Basically everywhere, I have never seen an election day that didn't start with TV reports of, you know, bigger turnout than anybody's ever seen.
and long lines.
Yeah. I guess in fairness, we have been in an era of rising voter participation. Certainly, if you go back like 20 years, there's more people voting today than there was before. This is actually the flip side of a lot of the kind of hand-wringing, which in many ways is reasonable, about partisan polarization, that it does drive turnout. It drives turnout. There's no two ways about it. And there's a lot about our current political environment that, you know, there's a lot bad about our current political environment, but there's also a lot of things that Americans used to lament about American politics that we now have in spades. So anyway, we are going to, since it's one day out, it's sort of like the last day you get any like real information about the election. I know people really want to have some idea what's going on. And it's the day before, as I said, you get the non-information, which is just sort of crazy town, all sorts of anecdotal things that often as not just end up not meaning anything. So, and today we are joined by not only my co-host David Tainter.
Hey, Josh.
Hey. Also, one of our colleagues from our DC office, Cam Joseph, who does not exclusively campaign reporting, but is our campaign and elections reporter. So he's been around the country over the last few months, doing reporting on the ground in various places where there's highly anticipated or tight elections. And if you look at TPM today, our website, it's like all Cam all the time with a bunch of pieces that sort of, you know, kind of the overview of the Senate, the overview of the House races, the overview of the governor's races. So, Cam, hello. Welcome to the Josh Marshall Podcast.
Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. Well, before we get started, let me briefly share some words from our sponsor, Grady's Cold Brew Iced Coffee. Want in on New York's favorite cold brew? Of course you do. Head over to gradyscoldbrew.com for free shipping on all their greatest hits. Grady's famous coffee concentrate is cold brewed, delivering the strongest, smoothest, most refreshing iced coffee on the market, using a special blend of Indonesian and Ethiopian beans and chicory imported from France. Grady's has a touch of natural sweetness without any added sugar. Grady's is independently owned and operated and has been brewing in New York City since 2011. That's true. I've been a Grady's consumer. I feel like it's must have been almost from the beginning, because I remember, I think it was Hurricane Sandy. I remember getting like a special delivery because everybody
through the
like,
storm, stronger than the storm.
Yeah. No, I mean, my recollection of this is very clear. This was much earlier in Grady's history, and I guess I had already somehow or another I had already made clear publicly that I was a big Grady's fan, and as people know from the East Coast, you know, when you have a big storm coming in, everybody, you know, kind of the proverbial, they run to the,
yeah,
you know, the
market, up,
you get bread and milk and stuff like that. And we were like almost out of Grady's. And it was like, you know, what to do? I'm not sure if it was Sandy, because that would have been 2012.
Maybe Irene.
Yeah, it was, but it was a long time ago. It was a long time ago. Anyway, that was when we were talking about Grady's and chicory and no added sugar. Oh yeah, Grady's is independently owned and operated and has been brewing in New York City since 2011. Ready to give it a swirl? Get 20% off your first order at Grady'sColdBrew.com with promo code TPM. That's promo code TPM. So. And as I always mention, we're like hardcore consumers of Grady's here at TPM. I think not just in the New York office. You guys get it down there in DC too, right?
Yeah, you guys start sending it down here. And frankly, I think without the Grady's, I might not make it through election night tomorrow.
Cool.
Night,
well, there's that is a legitimate testimonial on behalf of of Grady's. So, Cam, here's the first thing I want to ask you. There's been a lot of kind of anecdotal, but also some very specific information that over the last 2 weeks, there's been a number of House races that Republicans were fairly confident that were, you know, if not locked down, pretty good shape, that seemed to get vulnerable late. And that is not an uncommon thing late in the cycle when you start getting more information. Walk us through that. What are the races that have appeared to become, you know, more contested very late in the cycle? And how do we know? Like, what do we base that on when we say things like that?
Well, there's a combination of things. And the biggest one is campaigns and super PACs putting their money where their mouth is. And what we've seen, and this is kind of a weird year, because the biggest thing we've seen that I've never seen before is House Democratic challengers outraising the Republican incumbents they're facing almost across the board. And sometimes in cases that it's, you know, 2-1, 3-1 fundraising edge. And that doesn't happen, frankly. Liberal donors' hair on fire approach to this election is putting a lot of races on the board that might not have been. And so it's a little harder this year to suss out how much of this is the National Republican Congressional Committee and the super PAC on their side, the Congressional Leadership Fund, going, oh shoot, we're getting outspent in a huge way, we don't want a surprise, and coming in with $500,000, $1 million in the closing weeks to shore up a candidate. And how much of this is those candidates are suddenly in trouble, they kind of didn't really worry about them, and all of a sudden the polls are shifting. And it's kind of a combination. Often one feeds into the other. But we've seen this in more than a half dozen races over the last couple weeks, where all of a sudden either the NRCC or the CLF is dumping $1 million into a race that, you know, I was hearing from them weeks earlier, yeah, we're not really that worried about it, we're keeping an eye, but we should be fine. And I think the most interesting, the one that is close to my heart because I've covered Alaska a lot over the years, is Don Young is the dean of the House delegation. All of a sudden, the CLF over the weekend dumped in six figures to be making phone calls to help Don Young, who literally was on nobody's radar even up to about a week ago. And Young is kind of like a political cockroach. There's been a bunch of races that he looked dangerously vulnerable in and somehow pulled them out. And Alaska's very hard to pull. But he's in a real race, it seems, that I would be surprised if it's a double-digit race at the end of the day. I think he probably still grinds it out, but wouldn't bet on it. Other candidates, Jaime Herrera Butler out in Washington, is in like a slightly GOP-leaning district. She's kind of a talented, relatively moderate Republican out there who everybody thought was going to be fine. All of a sudden, the CLF came in with $500,000 for her. There's an open seat in the Tampa suburbs that leans Republican that all of a sudden Republicans are dumping a bunch of about 500,000 last I checked, it might have grown since then. So it's a seat the Democrats are hoping to pick up. And Dennis Ross retired there. All of a sudden, Democrats think they got a real shot. There's a Blue Dog candidate down there. I believe it's a Blue Dog. I know that Stephanie Murphy from the adjoining district, who's that one of the heads of the Blue Dogs, is helping her a lot. But so, I mean, these races, it's kind of like panic whack-a-mole on the GOP side right now. And right. a lot of these races, I think, they'll end up holding. But this, you know, one of the signs of a wave is all of a sudden you see a bunch of money coming in into these unexpected places. And we're seeing that across the House map. All of a sudden, these races that were marginally competitive, Scott Perry up in central Pennsylvania is another example, are looking very, very tight. And the, you know, and everybody remembers the big Georgia 6 race with Karen Handel beating John Ossoff and kind of broke a bunch of liberals' hearts earlier in the cycle. All of a sudden, Handel's in a toss-up race.
Yeah, I noticed that Cook just, I think today, moved that into the toss-up group.
Yeah, no, it's always reassuring. And Dave Wasserman over at Cook is very smart, and it's always good when I am reporting and thinking something and all of a sudden I see Dave doing the same thing. It means that I'm not crazy. And definitely check them out as well as us to kind of get a lay of the land. But yeah, it's a real jump ball, and public and private polling has all of a sudden shown Handel down within the margin of error in the last couple of days. And Stacey Abrams at the top of the ticket there is fueling huge black turnout, and that could really pay some down ballot benefit to the Democrat running there. So, you know, I'm not guaranteeing any of these races is going to flip, but Democrats basically have about 16 seats that they think they're going to flip that Republicans are not disagreeing with right now. There's another 10 that are heavily contested on both sides that Democrats think that they're better situated than the Republicans do. And just those seats by themselves, the seats that I would say maybe don't lean Democrat but tilt Democrat, if I had to put money on it, I'd bet on the Democrats, they're going to win. And just those by themselves, if they sweep them, give Democrats the majority.
But then only just barely, right? Like it'd be like 25 seats, so like you're kind of like a two-point, like a two-seat. Like
sure,
those would do it, but yeah, all, but close. Yeah,
that's absolutely true. And the caveat here is, you know, if everybody's wrong by a couple points about the assumptions about voter turnout and the models are wrong, we could see a slight shift towards the GOP that ends up flipping a lot of seats one way or the other. But that could also happen in the Democrats' direction with all of these pure toss-up seats. And, you know, I think that the lowest prediction, you know, the best, rosiest prediction of any Republican I talked to over the last couple of days has been we're going to lose the majority by about 3 seats. We're going to be down about 26. And that assumes that every single race that is tied goes to the GOP, which, you know, I'm not sure how big a wave this is going to be, but clearly Democrats have the momentum right now. And, you know, the 7-point lead on the national ballot, generic ballot, has been pretty steady over the last couple of months. And while these districts are GOP leaning, there's just a ton of opportunities on the map for Democrats to break through. And I think that, you know, there's still within the realm of the possibility that Republicans hang on to the House, but I think it's at least as likely Democrats top 40 seats picking up in the House.
Yeah, that's kind of, I mean, you focus on a point that I have been thinking a lot about, sometimes, hopefully, other times with a lot of anxiety, that you do, as you said, that it seems that, you know, nothing guaranteed, but there do seem about 25 seats that are, you know, maybe 15 of them quite likely to go to the Democrats, another 10 or a dozen pretty likely, and that's just about enough for a majority. And then, but then you've got, like, you know, depending on which, you know, kind of prognosticator you look at, you see different numbers, but, you know, 40, 50 seats that are legitimate toss-ups. And, you know, there's a whole bunch of things there. You could have, you know, just slight, you know, pollsters modeling the electorate a little bit off in either direction. You could have it, you know, massively turn in one direction or another. But yeah, it's, you know, one thing you said about fundraising, I just saw an ad, I posted it on the site from this, I can't remember her initials. It's Texas 31. The candidate is Hagar, something Hagar.
MJ Hagar.
MJ Hagar. All right. Now, this is sort of like a race that most of the prognosticators consider likely Republican. So sort of like not impossible, but like, you know, you're talking, it has to get into big wave territory to get there. But, you know, a real race. And one thing I noticed, I don't think it's actually been polled. I couldn't find a public poll of that race. But in any case, the point that what I wanted to mention is that I looked and she seems to have outraced him by like 3-1.
Yeah. And that was one of those cases. She's got a really impressive resume, female veteran, a senior member, if I'm remembering correctly. She was a helicopter pilot that got shot down. She's got tattoos to cover her shrapnel wounds. And she had this amazing campaign video that all of a sudden vaulted her into insane fundraising numbers that I think she's still the underdog in that race. I've heard about some private polling that makes it seem like that's unlikely to happen. But the fact that Republicans are having to go in and spend for John Carter in a district right. that president, that actually has moved a little bit away from, towards the Democrats. Trump won it by about 12. Romney had won it by 20. But it's on the field, and it's a place where Republicans are having to spend. And this is the first time since Citizens United that we've actually seen Democrats with a fundraising advantage.
Now, is that one of those races that the Republican committees have gone in late with her? I mean, and I want to be clear with listeners. I mean, as I said, this is the prognosticators rate it as a likely Republican. That means like it's pretty Republican and pretty likely to stay
frankly,
Republican.
I mean, as amazing a candidate as she is, I think that's. If Democrats are winning that seat, that isn't the tipping point seat for the House. That's all of a sudden Democrats are talking about a 50-seat gain, and we're talking about a wave that I think that is on the edge, but not really kind of it. It's could happen, but it's unlikely to happen.
Right, right. But it also shows you that
there's candidates all over the map like that, and we've seen. The actual campaigns, the Democrats are outraising the Republican incumbents. Usually, if you're feeling good about a House challenger, they're raising, $500,000 in a quarter, maybe $1 million in their final quarter. Some of these Democrats, Hager included, were bringing in $2-3 million in a quarter. That is just unbelievable. And it's put these Republicans on defense in a lot of places they weren't expecting. And forced the super PACs to expand. And the big difference this year is Michael Bloomberg's all of a sudden stepped up for Democrats. And while Sheldon Adelson is spending a huge amount on the GOP side, Bloomberg is almost matching that on the Democratic side and has kind of neutralized the super PAC advantage. At the same time, candidates get much better deals on their ad rates. And so when you're spending $1 million as a candidate, it's more like, $2-3 million as a super PAC in terms of how many ad points you're actually getting. And so in these races where Democrats have a huge fundraising advantage and caught the Republicans off guard, that is making a huge difference. And so it's feeling to me like a big wave. And I don't know how deep that wave runs. I think that one of the things President Trump has done over the last month, even though I think he's hurt the Republicans in the House overall, he's helped shore up a few of these, pretty solidly Republican districts that the only way Democrats were going to win them is if Republicans didn't show up.
Right.
So that might be limiting the upper limit of what we're talking about in this wave. But I think we're going to see a lot of surprises on election night. I think we're going to see a lot of races that, I kind of had my eye on that I might not even have mentioned in my overview that could break. And that includes someone like Don Young that I mentioned. That includes someone like Steve King, who was caught totally sleeping in Iowa. And I know our readers are pretty fascinated by it, to say the least.
Well, so here, let me ask you one thing about King, because he's actually, we're thinking along the same lines, because he was the next one I was going to bring up. Obviously, for all the reasons that I think, as you just suggested, our reader, we've been writing about Steve King forever for all the kind of all his craziness and all of his, I don't know if he's become more of a white nationalist in the last couple of years, but he has definitely become he has become more and more overt. But the thing that interests me, and this is what you were just kind of alluding to, you will have, and he's an example of something that I think will be, there will be more examples, whether they lose or not is another question. But you have these cases often in the redder districts where someone just didn't know they were going to be in a tight race and they find out too late. So walk us through That's I assume you saw this thing where he's running this ad from 2014.
Yeah, I was just going to say that.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, he didn't even have time to make new ads. I mean,
or even like redub the ad, right? You can like redub an ad. Anyway, so yeah, tell us about
it's kind
Steve
of amazing
King.
Because yeah. In that ad, it kind of cracked me up. He says something along the lines of like our country's going the wrong direction and slipping away, which obviously as a Republican in a Republican district in 2014 with Obama as president was a very effective argument. It sounds a little weird with President Trump in office if you're a big Trump supporter, which King is. I think King probably wins. I don't think it's a slam dunk. We've seen some last minute polls that show him up, you know, 4 or 5. And he basically committed a huge error by not taking this race seriously. And, you know, it's a district that President Trump won by almost 30 points, but it's also a district that President Obama only lost by about a point in 2008. It's one of those big swing districts that swung big and hard away from Democrats. And, you know, I think King has a very different reputation in Iowa than he does nationally.
Let me ask you one question. So yeah. My understanding, this is, I think this is sort of a district that has a lot of, you know, agricultural communities, tend to be mm-hmm. wider, tend to be older, but then has a few, you know, cities that we would call pretty small from the East Coast, but ones that are that have a, you know, are very different. So I guess that gives it, you know, it's not exclusively those probably what Steve King considers his base.
No, and it's interesting because, you know, I mean, it's a huge farming and pork community, but that a lot of the pork producers, you know, a huge amount of Hispanic influx, now they're not voting at very high rates. And you know, the Ames is where Iowa State University is. There's a little group of Democratic voters around there. Sioux City is pretty conservative, but not dyed-in-the-wool Republican. And they tend to be, you know, more business conservatives. I mean, frankly, like, there's a reason Steve King is who he is and that he's kept winning. It's a very conservative district, but it's not a district that is absolutely impossible for Democrats to win, and they made a real effort with former Iowa First Lady Kristi Vilsack in 2012. He ended up beating her pretty easily, but he took that race really seriously, and he spent about $4 million, and he's been outspent in this race dramatically. And so, you know, I mean, I think it's unlikely, but the fact that we're talking about Steve King shows what type of year we're in. And, you know, if you look just at the toss-up races that are all of a sudden looking not great for Republicans. You know, someone like Tom MacArthur in New Jersey was somebody that everyone thought was going to be a competitive race, but he probably would be fine. And that looks like a pure coin flip to me. And, you know, he's known because he was the so-called moderate who helped hit on the agreement with the hardline conservatives to get Obamacare repeal through the House. Karen Handel that we talked about, you know, that was a race that once she won her special, we're like, okay, it's probably not going to happen in the general. We just saw a big, really close contested race for Troy Paulderson in the Columbus area in Ohio, where he ground out a win in a special election in August. All of a sudden, he's back on this list because his opponent, even though he lost, Danny O'Connor, is raising and spending a lot more money than him, and Republicans have had to go back in there. You know, Dave Bratt, we've talked about for a couple months. But you know, all these races seem to be shifting. You know, there's more and more races that are being added to, you know, where I really feel like these are jump ball races that even a couple of weeks ago, seeing the polling and seeing the spending, I wasn't convinced. And, you know, I saw this in 2006, I saw this in 2008, some late breaking races. We saw it the opposite direction in 2010 and even in 2014. People getting caught by surprise, and not all of them lose, but that usually indicates that the party that they're a member of, something's wrong.
Right.
And we're seeing that shift.
I think I saw that, you know, when Steve King went, and I think he went up with that ad like Friday or maybe at the earliest mm-hmm. Thursday, I thought I saw that his campaign as of now, I guess it wouldn't have been, I'm not sure whether it was as of that day or the last reporting period, but he only seemed to have like $150,000 in his, you know, in the bank account for his campaign.
Which is kind of astounding given that he has been one of the best fundraisers in the Republican Party in past years. I mean, I don't remember the exact figure he brought in 2012, but he is a Tea Party darling and raised upwards of $4 million for that race, if I recall correctly. And he just didn't this time.
Yeah, I mean, he's certainly someone who, like, you know, he's got a big, I mean, maybe a little less so now with the things that have happened in the last few weeks, but he's always had a big cable news, you know, presence. So he's definitely the type who, you know, with direct mail and sort of, you know, digital solicitations could raise like a ton of money. I mean, absolute ton of money. So, yeah, it's crazy that he...
That's campaign malpractice that he's in the position.
Yeah, no, totally.
And, you know, he's maybe the most controversial, but there are plenty of other Republicans who the national folks are tearing out their hair and furious that they're having to spend money in a year where Republicans don't have a bunch of money to waste to shore up these guys. And, you know, Ted Budd in North Carolina is one that the Republicans are pissed off that they're having to spend money on. Mia Love in Utah looks like she's more likely than not to lose.
And that's the Salt Lake City seat, basically?
Yeah, it's mostly suburban, but it's almost all in Salt Lake County. And, you know, it's these dyed-in-the-wool Republicans who've really never warmed up to Love. She's underperformed in that district the last two elections. And also hate Romney. Don't hate Romney. They love Romney. They hate Trump. And right. So that's, you know, if I had to say, I think she's going to lose. And that's a race that has a very good local candidate, Ben McAdams, who's a Salt Lake County mayor. He's very well known in the district, and you know is running a lot of the district already.
Who was the guy that she beat? And she just won in 2016, right? Or am I?
No? She won 14 against Jim Matheson, who's a longtime Blue Dog Democrat back when the Blue Dogs had a lot of power. That's an interesting thing that's happening now. You know, Blue Dogs were kind of what Democrats made their majority on the last time. And there are obviously a lot of Democrats who were much more conservative than most of the party and represented these districts that, you know, should be Republican, frankly. And when the 2010 wave came, they wiped them all out. I mean, I think there's 50-something members and all but about a dozen lost their races or retired. We're seeing a bit of a resurgence. Blue Dog Democrats think they have a shot of picking up, you know, maybe a dozen seats this time around, maybe even more, and could almost double their numbers in Congress. And once again, if we're looking at a Democratic majority, it's because of members who, you know, maybe are not as doctrinaire liberal as a lot of folks might want to see on the left, but can win in their districts, at least in a year like this. And I think the big question, if Democrats do win the House now, is how do they manage keeping those folks in office and try and hold the majority in 2020 when it's not clear things are going to be quite as easy for their party?
Right. Well, so that's a good segue to the Senate, because obviously in the Senate, we have a battleground that is almost all in red states. There's a couple exceptions where in Arizona, I'm not even sure at the beginning of the cycle we would have really thought of that as non-red, but it's clearly very closely contested. It seems to me that Sinema has a very, very slight advantage, but clearly that's a jump race. So, yeah. But you've got the big ones where, you know, like Heitkamp, which seems really tough right now. The Democrats had some hopes in Tennessee. That seems, you know, considerably longer shot right now. Missouri, where Claire McCaskill really, you know, in some ways by rights should have lost her reelection match in 2012. And then she was blessed with her opponent, and then she pulled through. So what are, you know,
it's a tough map, but yeah. It's interesting to me. This is harder to game out the Senate this year than the House, because we have two countervailing currents. One of them is that clearly there is a bit of a Democratic enthusiasm gap. The Democrats are going to vote. We're seeing Republicans voting at very high levels too, but not as high as the Democrats in most places. But at the same time, these are deep red states, and President Trump has polarized the electorate so severely that somebody who has won a lot of crossover votes in the past, like Joe Donnelly in Indiana or like Phil Bredesen in Tennessee, it becomes harder for them to do so this time around. And it's unclear to me which of those things is going to prevail. I think it's probably going to be a mix of the two. But, you know, basically we're talking about a map that Democrats are panicking about even before Trump won. And frankly, his win probably has saved a lot of these Democratic seats, because, you know, there's a lot of states that Trump carried that are off the map right now. The Democrats are going to win re-election in Wisconsin, in Pennsylvania, in Ohio, in Michigan. It looks like Joe Manchin's going to win in West Virginia. That probably doesn't happen if Hillary Clinton's president right now. But right. at the same time, you know, these Democrats, there's five Democrats in states that Trump won by 19 points or more. And you mentioned McCaskill and Donnelly. And then Phil Bredesen, who's mounting a very credible, serious race in Tennessee that I think is closer than people realize. I've been hearing some conflicting numbers from both Democrats and Republicans.
Yeah, I've heard the same thing.
I would not count him out. And Democrats are feeling, you know, until about 6 weeks ago, Democrats still thought it was a remote but real possibility they could win the Senate. And then the Brett Kavanaugh hearings happened, and that hurt, that energized Republicans. That put a lot of these red state Democrats in tough positions, including Bredesen, who said he would have voted for Kavanaugh, and Heidi Heitkamp, who I think some Democrats concede was probably going to lose anyways, and her vote against Kavanaugh was more of a moral statement. That, you know, it hurt, but all of a sudden in the last week, and I think this really started shifting with the mail bombs sent to a bunch of prominent Democrats, and then the tragedy in Pittsburgh, where President Trump's fear-mongering on immigration was not cutting through as well. He was, and that some of these moderates in conservative-leaning, but not, you know, have voted for Democrats in the past, voters in these states, paused. Mm-hmm. And we've only seen a limited data. Part of this is we're kind of flying blind. Smart campaigns rarely poll in the last week of the election because at that point they can't make decisions off of it. They've decided what their last ad is going to be already. So we're flying a little bit blind, but there's some signs that Democrats are doing better in these places. And, you know, about 10 days ago, I would have said, I think Claire McCaskill's done. Today, I think she's got a shot. I probably still rather be Holly and Herb, but that's going to be a very close race. And Tennessee is the same thing. Phil Bredesen has seen booming early vote turnout. It's hard to compare because there hasn't really been a serious midterm election in that state in years. But Democrats are not counting him out, and they think that it's tied. Republicans think that Marsha Blackburn's got a bit of a lead. Heidi Heitkamp is really the only Democrat that Democrats think is probably done. But even some of that, you know, even she's not being totally counted off by Democrats. And on the other side, there's some Republican seats that Democrats are hoping to pick up. Nevada looks good for them. Arizona looks very tight. And part of that was Martha McSally, the Republican in that race, is a very strong candidate, but had to deal with some real hardline anti-immigrant Tea Party types in the primary, including Joe Arpaio and Kelly Ward, and ran hard right to ward them off. And then kind of stayed there, surprisingly, in the general election. And I don't think that's necessarily been helpful for her. But, you know, Kyrsten Sinema, who she's running against, has spent a ton of money portraying herself as this very moderate, working across the aisle, blue dog Democrat, which she has been in Congress. But she, before that, was a very lefty Green Party activist, anti-war activist, who said some kind of harsh things about Republicans. And you made a joke that was caught on video that Republicans are now using in ads, talking about, you know, states are laboratories of democracy. Arizona seems like the meth lab of democracy. Probably not helpful if you're trying to win over, you know, GOP-leaning independent in this state. And so that race has tightened. I probably think Sinema grinds it out there, but it's unclear. There's just a lot of margin of error races on the Senate side. And
one thing that I know, you mentioned with Heller, you know, we both know there's this guy, John Ralston, who is like the dean of political reporters in Nevada. A couple years ago, he broke off on his own. He now runs something called the Nevada Independent, which is, you know, it's one of these, it's a independent news organization that I believe is structured as a nonprofit. You know, certainly if you are in Nevada or interested in Nevada politics, definitely worth like subscribing or whatever their kind of donor framework, blah, 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 blah is. But, and I'm sure you saw
he's
this.
Terrific.
Yeah, no, he's it. And that for a weird set of reasons, that state is one where they really have experience looking at the early vote and, you know, not knowing certainly what's going to happen, but knowing who's in the driver's seat going into election day. And I guess it was, I don't know if it was yesterday or Saturday, he did sort of, you know, his roundup of the final look at the early vote. And he basically, you know, he's not saying it's a certainty, but he thinks that the Republicans, both on the Senate and the gubernatorial side, you know, are kind of have their backs up against the wall and really need to have a, you know, a very strong Election Day performance to pull it out. And so that put that race, made it seem like a better situation for the Democrats than maybe just the polls did.
Yeah. And you know, in all fairness, the Republican strategists I've talked to there are a little more bullish about it than Ralston, who basically is saying it's a done deal.
Okay.
But I'm looking at the same early vote numbers he is, and the numbers look very good for Democrats. Basically, what they need to do is run up huge turnout in Clark County, which is about 2/3 of the state's population. It's Las Vegas and its suburbs. And it's where, you know, most of the Hispanic voters in the state live, which are a huge chunk of vote. Large Filipino community there, which tends to vote pretty heavily Democratic. It's where the unions are, and it's where these suburban female voters that are fed up with President Trump are largely. Although it's interesting, Washoe County in the north, which was usually Heller's base around Reno, Democrats have fought the Republicans to a tie there, which shows there's something going on with suburban voters up there too. Heller has had huge numbers in the rural counties, but there just aren't as many voters up there. So it's just tougher for him to pull it out. And he's been caught crossways. And he's one of the few Republicans on the Senate side who had this tough position where President Trump is not popular in his state, but he still needs Trump's base to win. And we saw Trump narrowly lost the state in 2016. Heller had been critical of Trump. He got, you know, he was kind of wishy-washy about how he was going to vote on an Obamacare repeal. He got a real primary from Danny Tarkanian, who's now running for the House, basically bear-hugged Trump as a result. And even though Tarkanian's dropped out, he's basically had to keep Trump by his side and keep him close throughout this election. And, you know, he'd been a relatively moderate Republican, kind of a sunny, friendly, inoffensive Republican that, you know, can win in that state. And this has hurt him there. And so, unlike most other Senate races, Trump is a net negative, a clear net negative for Heller in that race. And he's really struggled with how to handle him throughout the race. And so, yeah, I think the one pickup I'm pretty confident predicting, I think it's going to be close, but I would put money on Jackie Rosen over Dean Heller there.
So the one race we haven't talked about is the one that every Democrat in the country is funding, which is Beto O'Rourke in Texas. Now, in the last week or so, there has definitely been a tightening in the polls. What do you make of that race at this point?
I've been very bearish on Beto O'Rourke for the last couple of months. He raised a ton of money. For a while over the summer, I thought he had a real shot. Ted Cruz has been up outside the margin error against him for the entirety of the race, basically. And we haven't really seen O'Rourke's numbers moved up. That being said, I'm seeing something pretty amazing in Texas. Their early vote has already surpassed their entire vote from 2014.
Yeah, which is stunning.
And so Beto O'Rourke needed to do two things. He needed to fundamentally change what the electorate looked like, and he needed huge crossover support. And I'll add a third. He needed much higher Hispanic vote than we've seen in past midterms for Democrats there. And two of those things seem to be happening. The Hispanic vote still doesn't look great. It's up, but it's not up dramatically higher than the white vote in the state. And he does seem to be generating insane enthusiasm in bigger cities and suburbs for his campaign, including some places that are traditionally more Republican-leaning, like the Dallas and Houston suburbs. So I still think it's unlikely, but I am no longer writing off that race in the way that I was about 2 weeks ago, where I was basically saying he needs to do something unprecedented. I'm seeing something unprecedented there. And that doesn't give him a likely win, but I think that put that race back on the map in my mind. I think that Tennessee is actually probably still a better shot for Democrats. I think Phil Bredesen is running a very strong race there. But you know, I think all of these races are close. I think that race looks less close than a lot of others, but there's also something weirder happening there, and I'm not exactly sure how that plays out.
The one thing, and this is, again, it's we all have to be, careful when we look at elections to, you know, bracket our hopes from our analysis of the facts in front of ourselves. One thing I noticed, and I'm not the only one, because it's Jennifer Duffy who is the name of the woman who does the Senate for the Cook Report, right? Am I?
Yeah.
Okay. This is something that she flagged and is one of the reasons that she had sort of, you know, unlike a lot of other prognosticators, prognosticators, not exactly the right way to put it. I mean, it's not like, you know, Jimmy the Greek or something like that. You know, people who, election analysts, had kept the Texas race as a toss-up. And to be clear, people use toss-up to mean different things. I don't think she ever thought it was like a 50-50 thing. But they use the term a little differently. But in any case, still, it was a significant thing that she was keeping it and has kept it in the toss-up category for the Koch Political Report. And one of the keys is that Ted Cruz does not have his own get-out-the-vote operation. He has basically, whether you want to call it outsourced it or kind of joined in with Governor Abbott's get-out-the-vote operation. And, you know, as you've said, Cam, with many of the data points in this cycle, you know, it cuts both ways. It's a Republican state. Abbott's a very successful politician. He's probably, to a great degree, inherited the machine that has, you know, dominated Texas for the last 25 years.
Yeah, I think he's even built a better machine. He had a really, really crushing, impressive showing in 2014, which I'm sure Democrats, you know, so fondly remember Wendy Davis, who was supposed to be the Democrat who suddenly turned Texas purple.
Right.
You know, I think Beto O'Rourke has done a lot of things that Wendy Davis failed to do in terms of actually energizing voters and raising the money that he needed to compete. But yeah, Cruz is dependent on the Texas Republican Party, which is a very strong organization. But
also hasn't had
Republicans, and some of those Republicans are Beto voters.
Right.
They're going to be Abbott Beto voters that Republicans are turning out. I don't think a ton, but enough that could be an interesting factor. So, you know, I mean, there's kind of the two buckets of the most interesting races because of the personalities and the candidates, and the races that I think are the closest. This is obviously an interesting race. I don't think it's the closest one. But if we wake up on Wednesday morning and Democrats have the Senate, Texas or Tennessee needs to happen for that to happen.
Right.
Unless Democrats pull out a miracle in North Dakota. And so, you know, those are races that we should be talking about. And obviously we are. I still think that Bredesen's more likely than O'Rourke to be a senator at the end of the day.
What struck me there, though, is that it Republican state, strong Republican machine. But it's also true I'm not sure. I think it's been a good 25 years since a Democrat has won a statewide election. And over time, that has to affect the dominant party's approach to GOTV operations. You know, he does. I mean, and Abbott is I think he's like a good 20 points ahead of his. So basically, he is cruising to reelection with like not the slightest doubt. So that is another thing that kind of got my attention, that Cruz has hitched his wagon to a race that is not even a race. So, you know, can cut either way.
I think Ted Cruz's team is one of the best in the country. They are doing their own turnout as well. I think they're not solely dependent on the Texas Republican Party, but they are certainly looking to them to some degree. And, you know, the big difference between governors and senators' races is that governors can raise unlimited sums. So Abbott just has a lot more money than Cruz, even though Cruz has been a strong fundraiser. And so
interesting. Okay.
That changes things in terms of how turnout operations can operate. But, you know, I mean, Ted Cruz, obviously.
So that would be a logic to him, sort of, again, outsourcing kind of gives a pejorative cast to it. But that would create a logic that he just has tons of money, so he can fund it much more easily, much more efficiently than the Cruz campaign. So Cruz campaign focuses on air war and stuff like that, and leaves it to Abbott,
and
but
frankly,
puts
I mean,
a lot
Texas
on Abbott.
Is just so damn big
yeah.
that turnout, ground game only matters so much because we're talking about 20 different media markets, and you know, it's the second largest state by population in the country. And so the idea that you're going to be able to...
Is it really 20 media markets?
I think it might be more. I think it might, once you count all the ones that like overlap with Oklahoma, it's like 23.
Interesting.
I've been told, you know, a week of saturation advertising there is upwards of $15 million a week. And so we're talking about Beto O'Rourke raising $70 million. That's a lot of money. But when you're talking about reaching into every media market in the state, that, you know, you need minimum $10 million a week on advertising.
Right.
And so, and then that's not even talking. I mean, I've heard that, I haven't confirmed it, but I've heard that Beto O'Rourke has about 700 field staff in the state. That's, you know, a couple of dozen in some of these mid-sized cities.
Right.
And, you know, in the Rio Grande Valley, which is where the largest Hispanic population is, which often doesn't turn out in midterms and often doesn't even turn out at very good levels of presidential levels, that only goes so far. And so a lot of it's about base enthusiasm. And O'Rourke has clearly activated even some, you know, Republican-leaning but suburban voters. Austin's on fire for him, parts of Dallas and Houston. But I haven't seen that necessarily translate into a lot of excitement with Hispanic voters, but
right.
You know, election will tell.
Right. So we're finishing up. So name a few races that you think may be sort of sleeper races that people haven't been, and it almost has to be in the House or governor's races, since obviously there's only, everybody's looked at the Senate races every single possible way. What are some races that may not be high on people's radars that you think are possible surprises on election night?
Yeah, well, we talked about Don Young and Steve King. I'm keeping a close eye on both of them. On the governor's side, Democrats have a real opportunity of winning the South Dakota governor's race. Kristi Noem is well-liked in D.C., but she's kind of underwhelmed on the trail a little bit. And she's facing off against Billy Sutton, who's this Democrat who is in a wheelchair because he was a professional rodeo rider who broke his back in an accident. And it's kind of like, you can't get much more South Dakota than that.
Yeah, that's really like MMA or like NASCAR for South Dakota, right?
It's kind of made for ads. You know, it's perfect. And it's made for, I'm not your normal Democrat in a state where that's important.
Right.
And Democrats think they're going to win there. If they hit it's very, very close. But that's a kind of under the radar sleeper race. And another race that I don't think is a sleeper, but people haven't really been paying much attention to, but the Iowa governor's race is very close. I think the Democrat Fred Hubble is going to pull that out against Kim Reynolds. Obviously, that has a lot of import for where the presidential goes in 2020. He could be a real kingmaker in the caucuses, but also, you know, that's a state that Obama won comfortably twice and Trump won comfortably. And it's a sign that it might be snapping back towards Democrats. And so I think that's pretty interesting. Obviously, Georgia has been talked to death, but I think that's a very important test. And Stacey Abrams has, like in Texas, generating huge early turnout, huge black turnout. Younger voters are turning out at historic rates. My gut tells me that probably goes to a runoff, but I'd probably rather, if anybody's going to win with avoiding a runoff where you have to get 50% in that state, I would bet she would do it over Brian Kemp. Although I think there's a good chance that we're looking at a December 4th runoff there. So those are a couple.
So there's like a Libertarian running too?
There's a Libertarian. I feel like there might be one other candidate on the ballot too. The Libertarian's been polling around 2-2.5%, which is historically about what they pull there. Every single public and private poll I've seen, or quality public and all of the private polls I've seen, have it a 2-point race one way or the other. And that's been true since about 2 weeks after Kemp won his primary runoff. And so what the electorate looks like matters a ton there. And if it's 49-47 at the end of the day, then we're looking at a runoff, which completely changes how things feel. But the early vote turnout for African Americans and younger voters has been bonkers. And if she can sustain that, I think that's a big if on election day. And the electorate has about 32% African Americans as opposed to the 28% we saw in 2014. I think she could pull it off.
And just for our listeners, you know, there's a lot of different factors, but it probably gets harder for her in a runoff because Libertarian, presumably those are going to go to Kemp more than to her. Is that broadly accurate?
Yeah, I think
broadly
even more
accurate?
Than that. I mean, it's just, you know, it's harder for Democrats to turn out their voters, especially when you're talking about these infrequent voters in the state. And so it just becomes trickier, you know, to do what she's done, which is pretty spectacular in terms of her field operation, twice.
Like, again, a month later, basically.
Yeah, and right after Thanksgiving and heading into the holidays.
Right.
It's just a tough time. Not an impossibility, but it's a tougher lift. You know, if she ends up a couple points ahead of him in the first round, I think that's a very competitive race. If Brian Kemp ends up leading her in the first round of balloting, I think that's a very tough lift for her.
Right, right. Okay. Well, listen, we have sated everybody's hunger for the final tea leaf reading, and
it is a big map this year. There's
yeah, no, it's really and I can't you've really captured this, Cam, but I can't stress enough how many races are very, very close, and the kinds of races that could totally go either way on election day. I mean, when you've got all the quality polls saying a race is within a sort of a 2-point bound, it's not even just margin of error in a statistical sense about polling. It goes to even making relatively accurate predictions about the shape of the electorate, that those could just go any way. And there's so many, and, you know, enough to have, you know, Republicans come out on, you know, the day after saying, like, wow, it looked like we were going to take a beating and we took a few hits, but we basically came out in one piece, or just getting decimated and, you know, losing, you know, maybe 50 seats in the House and possibly losing the Senate. So there's such a wide range of possibilities.
And I would say that Democrats not picking up the Senate and not losing seats in the Senate is a very good night for them. They had 10 incumbents in Trump states, just one Republican incumbent in the state Trump lost. And so this is already looking like a victory for Democrats on the Senate level, assuming that things don't slip and all of a sudden they're losing, you know, 2-3 seats in the Senate, which is, I think, almost as likely as them taking the Senate at this point.
Yeah.
But we're talking about Democrats winning potentially as many as a dozen or more governorships and rebuilding their strength across the states and having a real voice in policy in a lot of big states, a lot of swing states, Michigan, Ohio, Florida. These are important places.
Right.
And if they can flip the House, which I think is likely, and win all these governorships and minimize their losses, you know, you can spin it however you want. That's a very good night for Democrats.
Right, right. Okay, well, let's find, just to remind everybody, the Josh Marshall Podcast is brought to you by Grady's Cold Brew Iced Coffee. Ready to give it a swirl? Get 20% off your first order at gradyscoldbrew.com with promo code TPM. That's promo code TPM. Cam, thank you so much. I mean, I have all these like incoherent opinions, and so it's really good when I can talk to someone who actually knows all the details. So thank you so much. And let's all get ready for election night. It'll be a late night, and it'll be one with a lot of emotions for a lot of people. We just don't know who's going to have which yet. But thanks so much, Cam, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Josh.
All right. Thanks so much, and we will we'll almost certainly have another episode of the podcast later this week when we know kind of what's going on. So talk to you soon.
Bye, Josh.
Later.